Chapter 8 1947 Driving from London to Shacklehurst proved to be soothing, though the undulating countryside of Kent's High Weald was so different from the flatlands of her Belgian girlhood. Just being close to farms and fields always brought calm to her thoughts. She wondered if it was because she associated fields with escape, and escape meant freedom. Freedom from the past. There was also the ancient nature of a place, how it connected people and events, and how time moved on to heal wounds, for she knew that places bore scars as deep as those inflicted upon people who had suffered. Years after the First War, the one they said would end all wars, she had returned to Belgium and walked across land restored to the growing of crops, not the slaughter of human beings. Though many of the trenches had been filled or fallen in, white scars across the chalk soil exposed their former location, revealing what had once been no man's land threaded across fields of sugar beet, barley, and maize. It made her ache as if she were in the company of ghosts, and it crossed her mind that perhaps she was. Eleanor loved the names of places, curious about their origin and how they could change over the years. Weald, Wald, Weald. Then there was Shacklehurst. Shackle, to impede progress, to bind. She wondered how the name came about and suspected it was something to do with prisoners, possibly French prisoners from the Napoleonic Wars. Could she never escape one war or another? Despite the limitations of village life, Eleanor looked forward to being at home in her lair, the house at the edge of Denbury Forest. Yet there were times she felt both safe and vulnerable in her haven. Dueling emotions that kept her on her guard. The surrounding trees offered shelter and seclusion, but the dense foliage could also hide an interloper, perhaps camouflage someone from the past who would take her quiet life and offer only a silent death in exchange. Had she tried hard enough to keep hold of the settled existence her family had forged since they arrived in London in late 1917? And as wartime descended again and victory seemed so far distant, did she wallow in indecision for too long when asked to take up arms once more? Yet within a few months, what began as a request had developed into an order. Though the transition from respectful petition to command came at a point when she was angry, her mind and heart desperate enough to kill the enemy with her bare hands. Eleanor knew she had little choice but to obey those orders, not least because there was an open account with her name on it, and it listed the deaths of those she loved most in the world, deaths that were hers to avenge. Had her enlistment been delivered with an element of emotional blackmail? Yes, of that there was no question. It was time to talk to Jim and Rose. She realized that her immediate response to their plight was out of place, an emotional encounter akin to breaking an egg with a mallet. Yet she had been so incensed by Jim Mackey's rough treatment at the hands of his family that she had followed the men to London without applying much thought to the possible outcome, though it was the least of her worries. In allowing her own instant reaction to get the better of her, she had broken the law when she exceeded the petrol allowance by some 70 miles over just a few days. It might have appeared to be a lesser infraction against the many other felonies committed and laws broken in Britain's dark, rationed post-war world, but it was still a crime. The Home Office permission note Steve had furnished her with would help if she were queried by the local constabulary. It attested to her use of a vehicle while on government business. It wasn't a Scotland Yard document, so not for the first time Eleanor wondered about Steve Warren's field of influence. As she drove through Seven Oaks, her concerns converged with memories, and she smiled, recalling a linguistic error she made during a lesson at her new English school in West London. She had confused influence with effluence, and because the latter was often employed to describe the flow of sewage, the whole class had dissolved into giggles. Now she wondered whether her musings had returned her to the mistake for a reason, given that she was thinking of influence in connection with Steve Warren. Though her attention had lingered on the countryside as she negotiated bends in the road, changed gear to slow on a hill, or tempered her desire to be home and therefore her speed, she was also aware of the black motor car now visible in her rearview mirror. She adjusted the mirror and slowed down. The motor car reduced speed. There was no other choice, but the driver had been quick with his reflexes, more so than a recreational motorist might have been. She could see there were two men in the motor car, a passenger silhouetted alongside the driver. "I think it's time for me to stop," said Eleanor aloud. She slowed again as she approached Goodhurst, then pulled across the road to park alongside the village pond. She cast her gaze to her left as the motor car passed, with both driver and passenger staring straight ahead. She waited, wondering if the driver knew there was another circular route from her stopping point to Shacklehurst. Slipping the motor car into gear, she eased onto the road and turned right, then left onto a back street that was used only for deliveries to the corner shop, the butcher, and the pub at the top of the hill. She found a place to park, then locked and left the motor car while she continued on foot, looping around the back of the church to join the main road again. She carried a shopping basket, and as she approached the church, she pulled a headscarf from her shoulder bag, which she put on and tied under her chin. Affecting the gait of an elderly woman, she emerged onto the pavement, and there it was to her right, the black motor car parked under a tree. Walking any closer to the vehicle would have entailed an element of risk, so like an old lady deciding whether to step out onto the road, she glanced both ways, and in those few seconds garnered more information. The driver was standing alongside the motor car, looking back. He shook his head, leaned into the vehicle, and then took his seat once again. Eleanor continued on, a woman of a certain age rendered invisible by her vintage, on her way to the corner shop. She appeared of no account, a grandmother of the village who had never left the house where she was born, except perhaps for a day by the sea. Arriving back at her motor car, Eleanor removed the headscarf, threw the shopping basket into the boot, and her shoulder bag onto the seat next to her. She opened the flap and fingered the gun. Sighing, she shook her head, started the engine, and reversed out of the narrow street and back onto the road. Though this time, instead of joining the main thoroughfare to the right, she swung around to take the route to the left, a narrow lane that would lead to the little-known southern entrance to Denbury Forest. From there, she would bump her way along an old drover's road that terminated in Shacklehurst, close to home. Eleanor parked the motor car in the garage next to the house. The tape was still in place over the front door, but she left it where it was and instead chose to enter via the kitchen door. Once inside, she used her binoculars to scan the woods and farmland to the rear of her house. There was nothing to cause alarm, though she could feel the muscles in her stomach clenching, a sign that her senses were alert, whether she chose such vigilance or not. She would sit and think before going to visit Jim and Rose, and when she left the house, she would not walk along the road, but would use the path just beyond the back garden, the one to the right that followed the perimeter of the field. She would check to make sure there were no idling motor cars, and only if the coast were clear would she clamber over the 5-bar gate and approach the Mackey's cottage. No one would see her enter their home. In the meantime, there was much to consider, not least the identity of the men who had been following her. Men, she thought, who might not have been at all happy with their task, and who, it appeared thus far, had given up the pursuit with rather more ease than she would have expected. Unless they hadn't, which meant she had to prepare for them to be very good at their job. Whatever it was, she would be foolish to expect never to see them again. At first, Eleanor had thought the driver and passenger were men from the Mackey family, yet when she studied the vehicle in the village, she realized the motor car following her was the same Markey as the one she had seen waiting for Steve Warren in Whitehall Place. If she were not mistaken, it was indeed a motor car in use by the government, which in turn begged more questions. Why would someone in a senior government position want to know where she was going? She assumed senior because only a more powerful man would have access to such a motor car, and the petrol ration required to send his associates on a mission to keep an eye on her during the long drive down to Kent. Was there a connection to the Mackey family? More than anything, though, what was Steve Warren up to? Rose, Mrs. Mackey, is your husband home? Rose Mackey stood at the door to her cottage with Susie on her hip. The young mother looked as if she had been cleaning, her hair was tied back in a scarf, and she wore a pinafore with the ties drawn around her back and secured at the front. On her feet she wore a pair of slippers that had seen a good few years of service. "He should be back any minute," said Rose. "Is everything all right?" Eleanor smiled and nodded. She had no desire to concern Rose Mackey by adding more weight to that already upon her shoulders, though the conversation she had planned with the couple would in all likelihood escalate worries Rose harboured about her husband's family. "I would just like to speak to you both. It's about the incident on Sunday. I have some..." Eleanor knew she had to couch her words with care. "Let's just say that due to contacts I have in London, I think I might be able to help you." "Jim's funny about strangers." Rose bounced her daughter on her hip. "But it can't do any harm, can it? Come in, Miss White. Or is it Mrs., sorry, if I've put my foot in it?" "It's Miss White. And even if I were a married woman, I would not take umbrage on account of such a minor slip." Eleanor held out the package she had carried to the house. "I happened to be in London for a few days, and had to pop into Hamley's to get something for a friend. I saw this doll. She was so pretty. I wondered who might love her, and as Susie is the only little girl I know, I couldn't resist bringing it home for her. Apparently, this is the most popular doll in the shop." "That's so thoughtful of you, Miss White." Rose stood aside for Eleanor to enter the beamed cottage. "Come on, Susie, let's open this, and then Mummy will make a cup of tea for the nice lady." Much was made of opening the parcel, lifting the lid from the box and pulling away the tissue paper. Susie clapped her hands and grabbed the doll. "What shall we call her?" Rose looked at her daughter, then to Eleanor. "What do you think, Miss White?" "Oh, that's up to you and Susie." "Do you have a favourite name?" asked Rose. Well, I suppose I do. Two, actually. My father always called my mother Lottie, because he said Charlotte was too much like a queen, and my sister's name was Ceci, short for Cecily." Rose looked at Eleanor and nodded. "Lottie or Ceci, what do you think?" "Ceci," said the child, clutching the doll to her. "Ceci."
The back door opened and slammed, signalling that Jim Mackey was home.
"Love, you there? I've had to leave the dog out the back. She's got into that muck again, I tell you. They said she was a farm dog, but I don't know."
"We've got a visitor, love. Miss White, from along the road."
"Just a minute."
Eleanor heard Jim Mackey washing his hands at the kitchen sink. There would be no bathroom in the house. The kitchen sink was where everything from crockery to cutlery were washed, and where the child was bathed. Jim Mackey could be heard scrubbing away a day's work.
"Right then."
He came into the sitting room, wiping his hands on a small towel.
"Nice of you to drop in, Miss White."
He bent over, kissed his wife and child. There was a hiatus while he made much of the doll, his daughter impressing upon him the name chosen.
"Ceci. Sounds a bit Italian to me, you know." "Yes, yes,"
Jim Mackey laughed, laid the damp towel over the fire guard and sat down in one of the threadbare armchairs.
"I don't think you've come here to have a jaw about the late harvest this year."
Eleanor appreciated the man's candour. "No, I haven't. I've come because I think I might be able to help you. Or at least, I can try." Jim Mackey frowned. Then, as if correcting himself, he smiled.
"Oh, we're all right, Miss White.
He turned to Rose.
We've got our heads above water now, haven't we, love?
I don't think Miss White is talking about money, Jim, said Rose.
Jim turned to Eleanor, who did not wait for him to ask.
Mr. Mackey, Jim, I am quite aware of what happened here last Sunday. I believe you are being pressed, bullied into doing something you do not want to do, and I don't blame you.
Thank you for your interest, Miss White, but this is my business, and I can look after it very well if it's all the same to you.
His demeanour had changed, his back was ramrod straight, his brow furrowed.
And I can definitely take care of my wife and child. All I want is to live a quiet life here in the country, away from all that.
Jim, I don't want to offend you with this visit, but it was clear to me that they aren't going to let you stay away from all that.
Eleanor could feel Jim's annoyance rising, yet she held up her hand when she saw him about to speak.
Look, there is much I cannot tell you about my past and how I know things I know. But let's just say I have some important contacts where contacts count. I believe there is a very big, I suppose you would call it, a job being planned, and that's why they want you back.
Eleanor almost looked away as Jim and Rose Mackey stared at her. Susie saw her parents studying the visitor and peered at Eleanor, two fingers in her mouth, while she clutched the doll with the other hand. Rose turned to her husband.
I was grateful when Miss White came along and helped me the other day, Jim. You know, when the boys came down.
She fingered the place on the cheek where a liberal dusting of powder had been applied.
Jim nodded, though his frown remained as he stared at Eleanor.
Are you with the police?
I know people in the police.
Higher-ups?
Eleanor nodded. High enough.
Then you know there's rot everywhere, Miss White.
He leaned forward, his pale blue eyes cold.
There's something I'm going to tell you about my grandfather, and it's how our family goes about its trade.
Eleanor watched as Jim Mackey looked over toward Rose and reached for Susie as if cradling his child would provide the fortitude he needed to go on, as if she could gentle him. She could see that despite the strength he would show before his wife and daughter, Jim was a fearful and troubled man.
My grandfather built the family business, that's what they call it, the family business, through what he knows about the people he knows and the people he wants to know. That's the, what would you call it?
Mackey scratched his head as if searching for a word.
That's the foundation of his bloody empire.
Jim.
Sorry, Rose, language I know. Beg your pardon, Miss White.
Mackey held his daughter tighter. Susie continued to stare at Eleanor.
Go on, Jim, said Eleanor.
My father, his brothers and my grandfather have something on everyone who's anyone, whether they're in the police, the government, the House of Bleeming Lords, or members of your aristocracy, said Jim. He has enough to make people go blind and not see or do anything about what's in front of their noses, if you catch my drift.
Eleanor nodded. Are you saying that any detective with the flying squad or even a government minister may have been compromised by your family?
Depends what their game is, what they're up to.
He paused and handed Susie to her mother before drawing his attention back to Eleanor.
You see, whatever they plan, whatever they want to take, they don't have to try that hard.
He turned to Rose. His wife nodded for him to continue.
And it's always about taking, Miss White. They're not Robin Hoods, even though the people on the streets think they are. They only give if they want to receive, and they never want anything small.
He looked at his wife again.
Rose, I like it here, and we've done well, haven't we?
You're a hard worker, Jim, said Rose. You've put your back into making a go of it on the farm, and we have our lovely cottage. We just have to stand up to them, that's all.
Eleanor cleared her throat.
I understand all this, she paused.
Jim, is there anything you can tell me about your aunt?
Elsie?
You seem surprised I asked. Jim nodded.
I am. You know a lot about my relatives, don't you?
He sighed, as if resigned to Eleanor's understanding of his family.
Sorry, Miss White. I can see you just want to give us a hand. I'm not taking offence. Well, I am. sort of, but anyway, yeah, Aunt Elsie's all right. She's got her little rackets going.
He rubbed his forehead again and was thoughtful.
But it's funny you should mention her, because when I was a nipper, I always reckoned she was a bit of a dark horse, you know, among all them men. My dad and my uncles are protective of her, but on the other hand, they like to control everyone in the family.
He held out a hand to Rose, who took it in both of hers.
We thought we were shot of them until my brothers came down here.
Is there anything you can tell me, anything you know about what your family plans to do next that might help me to help you?
Well, there's definitely something on the cards. They wouldn't tell me what it was unless I agreed to go back and work for them. I said no and got a beating for my trouble, and they couldn't keep their hands off my Rose here either. I should have been able to protect her, but...
He looked away for a moment as if to compose himself before turning back to face Eleanor.
You know, the only ambition I have now is to get behind the wheel of the new Massey Ferguson tractor old Wicks said he was going to buy for the farm.
He laughed, though Eleanor could see it was false, an attempt at lightness. Eleanor came to her feet, ready to leave.
Thank you, Jim. If you're agreeable, I'll continue to do what I can to protect your life here.
Jim Mackey glanced at his wife, who gave a brief encouraging smile as he squeezed her hand. He nodded toward Eleanor, stood up and walked with her toward the door.
"What I want to know," said Jim, opening the door, "is what you think you can do to be honest, Miss White. I still can't get over how you know so much about my family. I'm flummoxed, to tell you the truth. I don't know how to take it, whether to be angry or thankful for you coming here. Though I'm much obliged to you for thinking of us, but I wonder if you know what you're taking on, because believe me, if you get involved, you'll see some terrible things. I mean, Rose and me, we're grateful you think you can help us out and all that. But why would you want to go up against my family? They're too powerful. And the more time I've spent away from them, the more I can see how bleeming dangerous they are. I was brought up with it, and thought it was the way everyone was until I went into the army and met all sorts of other blokes who came from ordinary families. It's not normal that my dad has had people topped to protect the family's business. Even them as works for him have lost their fingers for getting something wrong on a job.
Eleanor reached out and placed a hand on the young man's arm. I know exactly what I'm taking on, Jim, and I suppose what I want to do is stop whatever is in the offing. I want to stop anyone who would try to intimidate a young family, a family with a lovely little girl like Susie. Jim turned away, his back to Rose and Susie as he lowered his voice to a whisper.
They don't care about Susie, and that's why I'm torn.
If I do what they say, my family is at as much risk as if I don't.
His eyes filled with tears.
They don't even care about me. Just always what they want from me.
Jim, perhaps they don't care, but I do, said Eleanor. She reached for the door handle and turned to Jim and Rose Mackey. They are predators, and on my watch, you will not be prey. Eleanor could not settle, which was why she was soon on her way back to London, this time on the train. She would not be venturing much beyond the West End, so train, tube and bus would serve her well, along with the fact that she would not be breaking the law by using precious petrol, and her neighbours in the mews would not be disturbed or intrigued if they heard her motor car rolling into the garage below the flat. Before taking the bus from Shacklehurst to Paddock Wood to catch the London train, Eleanor stopped at the telephone kiosk, placed a call to the famed hairdressing salon, and asked if she could book a haircut.
Shampoo and set? Asked the receptionist.
Shampoo and set.
I'm afraid Mr. Raymond's diary is full, but one of the assistants can do your hair. They're all trained by Mr. Raymond himself.
Eleanor hoped she was correct in suspecting Elsie had a standing weekly appointment and they would therefore cross paths in the salon.
I don't mind. My hair is very easy to cut and I don't require too much in the way of, you know, rollers. Don't worry, madam. We'll have you looking like a Paris mannequin by the time you leave.
Eleanor thought about Elsie Finch, She had never seen anything less like a Paris mannequin and wondered how easy it would be to wash out whatever the well-trained assistant put onto her hair. From Charing Cross, Eleanor proceeded straight to the salon. If she had not lingered when she saw the motor car draw up outside and Elsie alight and then enter, they might have bumped into one another at the door.
"Now then," said the young woman standing behind Eleanor.
"Madame has let her hair grow rather long, hasn't she?"
"She has. I mean, I have. Not flattering, madam. Let's snip it a bit here and add some layers. Lift the hair and you lift the face, I always say. Then we'll pop in some of the larger rollers to add some buoyance. You won't be under the dryer for long. There's a Vogue on the table, so plenty to read."
Eleanor kept her eyes closed long after the shampoo was lathered and rinsed, and at one point the hairdresser asked if Madame would please open her eyes so she could ensure the cut was correct and flattering for Madame. Eleanor's usual mode of keeping her hair under some control was to go to a barber in Tunbridge Wells, who could be trusted to take off no more than an inch of hair, and who would watch while she pinned it up in a French twist again and put on her hat before leaving. However, soon she was sitting under a hairdryer next to Jim Mackey's aunt. It did not take long to engage her in conversation when they both reached for their latest copy of Vogue at the same time.
"Oh, please, you take it. Last month's copy is still here. I'll read that one," said Eleanor.
Elsie nodded, smiled, and expressed her thanks.
"Mind you," said Eleanor, "I rather like the costume that model is wearing on the front cover of the new edition."
Elsie took up the bait.
"It's very nice, isn't it? I've seen that one in Fenwick's. They've just got it in."
"Fenwick of Bond Street? Oh dear, I haven't crossed the threshold there since before the war. Is that where you shop?"
The woman nodded and looked sideways at Eleanor, to the extent that she could, given the restriction placed on movement by the dome-shaped hairdryer.
"The war's over now," said Elsie Finch. "And as my late husband always said, life is for the living to go on living, so I make it my business to enjoy my days out across the water."
"I know what you mean. I try to come up to London regularly, if I can. I live near Tunbridge Wells now. Lovely town, but it's not London. Even with the bomb sites, our town has still got life in it, hasn't it?"
"That's what I always say," said Elsie, closing the magazine. "There's life in the old girl yet."
Eleanor laughed. "A woman after my own heart. I treat myself to lunch or tea somewhere nice, and then when I've walked along by the Serpentine or somewhere like that, I go to the station a new woman." Elsie studied her watch.
"Pity, I have an engagement after this, or I would suggest we go to Fortnum and Mason for a cup of tea and a slice of something nice."
She lowered her voice. "But I will say this. Let me know if you'd like that costume on the front of Vogue. I have a special account there and can get something knocked off the price." Eleanor put her hand on her chest.
"Oh, I doubt I could afford it, even with a customer discount."
"Yes, you could. I'm good at knowing what suits people and the best size for them. When will you be here at the salon again?"
"You know, I don't think I'll wait too long. I'm having so much fun now I've added this salon to my day. I think I'll come again in a week."
"This is my day with Raymond, so tea next time it is."
An assistant approached to turn off the hairdryer above Elsie's head, which allowed her to face Eleanor.
"I beg your pardon. My name is Mrs. Elsie Finch. And yours?"
Eleanor held out her hand. "Miss Eleanor DeWitt."
"French?"
"My father was Belgian."
"I hope you weren't there during the war."
"Oh, no," said Eleanor. "I was safely over here, thank goodness."
"Madam," the apprentice indicated it was time for Elsie to move to the next stage of her coiffure.
"Better get on," said Elsie.
Eleanor nodded as another assistant arrived to switch off her dryer and lead her to the chair, where Belinda would lift her hair and, as a result, her face. Her hair was still being teased into the style imagined by Belinda when Elsie Finch approached and leaned toward Eleanor.
"Lovely to meet you, Miss DeWitt. I'm looking forward to tea next week. Oh, and I'm off to Fenwick's now. Bit of window shopping. You never know what I might find there."
She smiled, waved to her hairdresser and left the salon. Belinda commenced styling Eleanor's hair, then caught her attention in the mirror.
Looks like you've made a friend there, madam.
She seems very nice. Belinda leaned forward, lowering her voice.
Between you and me, she is when she wants to be. She's a good customer here. Leaves a nice tip, but I would never want to be on her bad side.
Oh dear, now you've worried me.
No, she would be all right with you. It's the young girls she can be a bit off with. Had me in tears when I was an apprentice. No, I would never underestimate that woman. Ever.
Eleanor nodded, surprised the hairdresser would express her opinion in such a way.
I wouldn't normally speak out of turn, madam, but you're a nice lady, so I thought it only fair to tell you. I am sure she wouldn't be a bit off with you, but I'm a believer in being forewarned is forearmed.
Thank you, Belinda. I appreciate your candour. Eleanor departed the salon, having left Belinda a generous tip, mostly due to the relief she felt when the new haircut was brushed and styled and appeared to be not too difficult to maintain. If all else failed, she could still sweep it up in a twist, which she was likely to do anyway. Tea with Elsie would come much later than she would have liked, but it was Belinda's comment that remained with her, and something else she overheard as she was settling her account. The hairdresser had extended her warning to an apprentice. It might have been her first week, thought Eleanor. Belinda had lowered her voice, though not enough to prevent Eleanor from hearing.
Be careful of that Mrs. Finch. If she were a man, they would call her a wolf in sheep's clothing. Don't put a foot wrong, or she will have you sacked. But if she likes you, you'll get a nice tip.
It occurred to Eleanor that it was the sort of indiscretion that would one day result in Belinda being sacked from the posh salon. In the meantime, it was a detail she could tuck away with all the other slivers of information she was gathering. Eleanor's next stop was Scotland Yard. The desk sergeant gave her leave to proceed straight to the office of Detective Chief Inspector Stephen Warren, where she noticed that the new blackboard had been set up in the corner, the white and coloured chalks still in their respective boxes.
"Linny, I wasn't expecting you back so soon," said Warren.
He gave a broad smile, came to his feet and pulled out a chair opposite his desk. With Eleanor settled, he took his seat again. "There was someone I wanted to see up here in town, and I thought I'd pop in. Do you have any news? I noticed Barb and Charlie are out today."
"They're always out, Linny. We've got more irons in the fire than just your suspicions about the Mackey family."
"Steve, I just want to do anything I can to protect Jim and Rose Mackey, and in the process, as I mentioned before, I think it would behoove you to investigate whatever is in the offing. It could be a feather in your cap, pulling out a thorn that's been in your side for some time."
"You have no idea how many thorns I have in my side, Linny."
He sighed while pushing around papers on his desk. Eleanor noticed that it was movement for the sake of moving, as the papers didn't seem to be in any particular order.
"Let me give you another idea of what we're up against. Last year, we had a gun amnesty. And can you guess how many were handed in?"
He pushed back his chair and stepped across to the blackboard, where he ripped the top from the packet of white chalks.
"No time like the present to use this thing."
"I would imagine..."
"Don't even try. I'll make it easy on you."
He began to write numbers on the board.
"There. It's just like school. The facts sink in a bit better if you can see them."
He opened the coloured chalks and underlined the numbers in red.
76,000 guns were relinquished, along with over 2 million rounds of ammunition."
He placed the chalks on the ledge at the foot of the blackboard, took a handkerchief from his pocket and wiped his fingers.
"Now, you know what that means, don't you?"
She nodded. "There's still plenty out there?"
"Bingo. And would you like to make some sort of stab as to one of the underlying problems we're having to deal with?"
He pulled back his chair and slumped onto the seat again. "Underlying problems?"
"I know, Linny. I sound like one of those psychiatrist types you'll find over in Harley Street."
He shrugged.
"Actually, to be honest, it was one of those psychiatrist types who told me what he thought was causing our biggest battles with crime now the war's over. Met him at a do I didn't want to go to, but the fella made sense."
"What did he say?"
"He said that the villains were suffering from an addiction to the adrenaline of battle. That these types, who were dodgy even before the war, did their bit when they were called up, and that the blood running to their heads when it came to fighting, firing off their guns, was the same as what happened to them when they're pulling off an armed robbery. Only it was worse, because when they came back, they wanted even more of that adrenaline flooding their bodies.
Eleanor met Warren's stare. She nodded. I can understand that.
Well, no, you can, Lenny. So can I. We both know it's why I do my job and why Bob and Charlie are good at what they do. But here's the problem. Everyone else is suffering from war fatigue.
Did the psychiatrist tell you that?
Didn't have to. But it's why the people just let them get on with it. And of course, as we know, the villains look after their own streets. After all, a dog doesn't mess in its own kennel.
Warren pushed back his chair and stood up.
So, Linny, when I see you come in here, having rushed to the aid of the young couple down the street who just happened to have a little girl, I didn't even have to ask myself why.
People like us can only live a quiet life for so long.
We were trained for something different, and sometimes the something different doesn't quite go as planned. But we were trained for that too. And then we came home, and here we are.
He shrugged.
Fiddling around with bloody blackboards and chalk as if we're kids playing schools.
I don't think I need any adrenaline, Steve. I like my life in the country.
I'm sure you do, said Warren. But if the country is so damn quiet and comfy, why are you carrying a pistol in that bag you have over your shoulder?
He stared at Eleanor.
Please, Linny,
don't risk your life. You've gone through... I'm right about the Mackies, Steve. Eleanor stood up. I'm your canary in the coal mine. But the difference is I'm going to make sure the explosion doesn't take Jim, Rose and Susie with it.
Then come back here when you've more for us to go on. Bob and Charlie are working on a bank job we've got wind of, but I've told them to keep sniffing around the Mackies just in case.
He paused, moving the pieces of paper on his desk again. He opened his mouth as if to say something more, but was interrupted by a knock on the door.
Yes?
Eleanor looked around to see who had entered the office.
Sir, said Val, I've a message for you. The call you were waiting for just came in.
She handed a piece of paper to Warren, who read the note, then crumpled the paper and pushed it into his pocket.
Thanks, Val. Miss White is just leaving, and I want to go through these letters before you type them up for me.
He lifted a folder and looked at Eleanor.
Yes, I must be on my way, said Eleanor. Off to run a few errands, I'll see myself out.
Eleanor departed the office, closing the door behind her. She thought Warren's manner, when the message was handed to him, had been odd. She knew Steve Warren, knew he was master of the quick quip and capable of bluster. It was part of his charisma, what drew people to him, and she had been one of them once. But the note had silenced what felt like a lecture in full flow. As she passed Val's desk, she noticed the white notepad from which the leaf of paper had been torn. There was no one nearby to bear witness as she tore the top sheet from the pad. When she reached the ladies' lavatory, she rested the sheet of paper against the back of the door, took a pencil from her bag, and, using the softest pressure, ran the pencil back and forth across the indentation left by Val's heavy hand until the words were revealed. Sir Perry G.W. 6, the usual place, he said not to be late. Eleanor tore the note into small pieces and flushed them away into the toilet, where they would soon rot into nothing, swept away in the effluence of London's Victorian sewers. Perry G.W. A sir, no less. A member of your aristocracy, as Jim Mackey might have observed. She would have to watch her back.